call the Senate Transportation Committee to order. Let the record note that it's January 25th at 1 o'clock. Today we are going to continue with our overviews of a number of agencies, three actually, and they're all related to transit and transit issues. And we're going to start with the County Transit Improvement Board and Mr. Peter McLaughlin. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am Peter McLaughlin. I am chair of the Hennepin County Regional Railroad Authority and also chair of the county's Transit Improvement Board. I appreciate the your efforts, Mr. Chairman, to put me on first. I have a county board meeting this afternoon, so I'll be able to rush back to Minneapolis and do that because of your putting me first. So I do appreciate that very much. Mr. Chairman and members, I'm here to talk about the county's Transit Improvement Board. This is the group that, under state law, was created 2 3/4 years ago to invest in the expansion of transitways. And the statutory direction was clear. We were to invest in transitways through a county-imposed sales tax that then gets thrown into a pot. And is in the distribution of the proceeds of that sales tax are then to be determined by a joint powers board. In doing that, we are to seek the advice of local governments through a committee that's called the GEARS Committee, and we'll get what that acronym means later in the presentation, because I always seem to bungle it if I don't have it in front of me. And then the goal, as indicated in the legislative history, was to maximize federal investment in transit by the federal – maximize federal investment in transit in the state of Minnesota. And we were to do this in a lean and mean fashion. In the statute, there is a requirement that the administrative expenses of the county's Transit Improvement Board could be no more than 0.75% of the tax proceeds. And we have done that over the history of the organization. Our vision is to create a network of connected transitways that's fully integrated with other elements of the transportation system. And that means with not only the bus system, but also with the road system as well. The goal here being to move users efficiently and safely, to mitigate congestion, to enhance development and the competitiveness of this region and this state, and then to improve sustainability and livability. The net result of that is this vision that's been pursued by the county's Transit Improvement Board for a variety of transit investments. I'm going to talk about some of those in the future here in my presentation. So what resulted was the creation of the county's Transit Improvement Board. 5 counties out of the 7 in the metropolitan area opted to impose a sales tax and to participate. The Carver and Scott did not opt to participate in imposing the tax and in the county's Transit Improvement Board. The 5 counties represent over 90% of the metro area's population and over 95% of the sales tax collected in the metropolitan area. So it was a 0.25-cent sales tax specifically for expanding transitways. And our definition of transitway is LRT, BRT, similar to what exists in the 35W corridor that's emerging there, and commuter rail. It's not about garden variety bus service. We were supposed to be looking at expansion of the systems in these big corridors for these types of facilities. That was what we've landed on. The current projections are that the sales tax would produce $89 million per year out of those 5 counties. Last year, it produced $91 million. So we've been meeting projections. Since 2008, the county's Transit Improvement Board has provided nearly $317 million in grants for transitway development, for construction, and for operation of transitways. So the way that this was done under statute was that the 5 counties and the Met Council collaboratively drafted and adopted a joint powers agreement for how we would work together. The first meeting, I will tell you, after the law was passed, there were 85 people in the room. I was chairing the meeting, and we had a blank piece of paper in front of us, and so other than the statute. And so we negotiated out this joint powers agreement. And within 5.5 weeks, 5 counties had enacted the sales tax, and those five counties had also adopted the joint powers agreement that we had negotiated out. The county's transit improvement board sets the criteria and awards grants from the sales tax proceeds. The grant evaluation and ranking systems committee, which is comprised of city representatives, county representatives, Metropolitan Council, that group advises CTIB on the priorities for the use of the sales tax. And the annual capital and operating grants are awarded for LRT, BRT, and commuter rail projects. This slide predates and includes some projects that occurred before the county's transit improvement board was established, but we have been very successful over the last decade in gaining federal tax dollars that our taxpayers contribute to invest in transit improvements in this region to the tune of $953 million from the federal government that has improved our transit system and our transportation system throughout this region with these investments. The county's transit improvement board and the sales tax is actually going to enhance our ability to bring in additional federal funds in the future, and you'll see that Central Corridor is only listed at $35 million. We are a couple months away, by best estimate, of receiving what's called the full funding grant agreement from the federal government for Central Corridor, which is the federal commitment to fund half of the cost of Central Corridor. That would be in excess of $420 million from the federal government. I'm sorry, $460 million from the federal government for Central Corridor. So we're in a position to bring down additional federal money into the region. As I indicated to you, we are meeting our estimated projections for sales tax collection, even though the economy has not been performing particularly well, $91 million in 2010. In addition to that, the resources that we had available in December of 2010, the County Transit Improvement Board, under statutory powers granted to it, agreed that we needed to bond in order to meet our obligations to fund Central Corridor in particular. We pledged 99.25% of the CTIB sales tax revenues to the retirement of the bonds, the remaining 0.75% of those administrative costs that are permitted to us. So we pledged those revenues in order to get the best interest rate that we possibly could. The overall interest rate that we got on the sale of these bonds was 3.9%, which is remarkable. We saved nearly $3 million present value by having Hennepin County, my county, issue the bonds for CTIB. Hennepin County is a known quantity in the capital markets, and was and CTIB is, as I indicated, only 2.5 years old. And so the decision was made that we should have Hennepin County issue the bonds, and the estimated savings because of that was almost $3 million in present value. So we issued those bonds in order to meet the capital commitments that we have primarily for Central Corridor. We issued them in December because the interest rates were starting to tick up in December, and our advisors and our in-house finance people said that that was the time to go. I checked with my budget director today. He thought that if we had issued the bonds today or yesterday, we would be paying an additional 30 or 40 basis points over what we paid by doing it in December. So we think we're trying to be good stewards with the taxpayers' funds by, one, having Hennepin County do the issuance, and two, trying to move it in a timely fashion to get the best possible interest rate. These bonds, because of those resources, we're going to be able to keep Central Corridor on time and on budget, which it has been so far, and we're committed to keeping that going. None of these funds can be used for operating grants. So our annual process, which we've got a number of governing documents, starting with the state law, our joint powers agreement, we have a transit investment framework that is our blueprint for how we're going to be investing the sales tax dollars. We have an annual financial review and capacity estimate where we look at all the projects, look at how much revenue would be projected in, and how much we need to be investing in capital and operating, I would note. As I indicated to you, Mr. Chairman, we are paying for half of the operating costs of the transitways in which we invest, and we've booked that into these 20-year projections that we have in our financial capacity estimate. We have an annual resolution that establishes the process by which we solicit proposals and eligibility criteria. And those eligibility criteria include the fact that, and this is by law, that any investment that the county's Transit Improvement Board would make has to be consistent with the Metropolitan Council's long-term transportation policy plan. In addition to that, so we have another mechanism that we use, which is that we make, for Central Corridor, for example, we made a commitment of 30% up to $300 million that we would invest over time in the Central Corridor. The reason that's important, we don't provide all that, all $300 million at any one time, but by passing that resolution and including it in the application to the federal government, we then had a solid plan that they would then review as we compete for federal funds that are going to pay for half of the cost of Central Corridor. We received a medium-high local financial plan ranking for the first time ever for our Central Corridor project, in large part because the county's Transit Improvement Board was able to say that it had committed to the up to $300 million for the, its 30% share of the capital costs of the project, and also that we had committed to half of the operating costs for Central Corridor and in the years ahead. So this is how the awards break out, the $317 million, largely capital, and then the operating contributions. The large operating contribution in 08 was the result of a $30 million one-time payment to the Metropolitan Council for operating expenses that were needed in that year. But the others, the balance of those operating contributions are associated with North Star and Hiawatha, and then represent our 50% share of the operating costs. And we moved it off of the property tax, which is where those dollars had been coming from. So there you get a picture of the geographic breadth of projects that have been funded to date. You also get an idea, a clear idea, that some of the projects that we funded are light rail, some of them are commuter rail, some of them are transit hubs, some of them are park and rides, and so we have a variety of uses to which our funds have been put. So the expectations of legislative supporters and stakeholders included property tax relief, that is, taking the operating costs that the rail authorities were having to bear, half of the operating costs, taking them off the property tax and having them picked up by this regional sales tax. The second expectation was a reduced reliance on state bonding, which is of particular interest to this committee. If you look at this pie chart, the upper pie chart is the North Star pie chart. When North Star was built, there was no County's Transit Improvement Board, no regional sales taxes in place. Half the money came from the federal government. Fully a third came from the state, and the county rail authorities in the form of property tax contributions contributed 17% of the funds. The bottom pie chart is the Central Corridor model with the County's Transit Improvement Board in place. Again, federal contribution 50%. The state is reduced from 33% to 10%. The rail authorities' property tax contribution, those are reduced from 17% to 10%, and the county's Transit Improvement Board sales tax kicks in 30%. So we've seen a major shift in the reduction in the state's responsibility and a reduction in property tax exposure for these projects, both of which I think are a positive direction for state policy. In addition to that, we were directed to expand the transit system, and we are doing that. Central Corridor is poised to go. We've made contributions to 35W and the Cedar Avenue Busway and a variety of other projects as well. There's a direct statutory requirement that the CTIP funds not be used to supplant existing funding, either capital or operating. And the expectation was that these funds would be used for construction, not studies. Put something out on the street that was going to provide service. There was a lot of concern that there were a lot of studies on a lot of shelves and a lot of offices, and that's not what this money was designed for. They wanted to put the put projects out on the street, and that is in fact what we have done. I think we've successfully fulfilled the statutory direction. We've kept our promises and met expectations. We have advanced consensus priority projects of the region with the sales tax. And though there's been a lot of discussion here of the legislative auditor's report about which there's some suggestion that there's a difference of priorities between the Met Council and the county's Transit Improvement Board, and that's really not the case. I mean, we have funded, and we have to, our funding has to be consistent with the Met Council's plan, but the consensus next LRT line was Central Corridor, and we made our first big financial commitment was to the Central Corridor. The second LRT line, the third LRT line, it would be, well, there's the consensus, and the Met Council has adopted this, is Southwest, and we've started to make investments in that. 35W and the Cedar Avenue Busway were two top priorities of both MnDOT and the Metropolitan Council, and we've been supportive of those as well. We've supported North Star, and we have worked with Washington County, which was in their projects really weren't as ripe as the projects in the other counties, and we worked out actually some special arrangements to actually allow them to do some additional planning and to guarantee that they receive some revenue so that they can decide what they want to have the region investing in their county, and we're providing help to them in that process. We have expanded transit ridership. Met Council's testimony in recent committees has been that two-thirds of the growth in recent years has in their transit ridership has come from transitways. We are helping to contribute to that. We think that we have contributed to the economic competitiveness of the region and the state, and we think we've delivered good value. CTIB has no staff. It doesn't own anything. It doesn't operate anything. We are in place to provide capital resources to advance the regional transportation vision through investment in transit. And I think we've done a good job with that. And this is the vision that we are attempting to pursue here with our investment. So, Mr. Chairman and members, I'd be happy to stand for questions.
Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, Mr. McLaughlin, thank you very much for all your work that you've been doing. Accomplished a lot. My question is, could you share with us a little bit of the background with the CTIB board alignment, how the board members are selected, and what their ratios are per county?
Yes.
And then also revenue receipts and expenditures per county. How do they delineate? How do they fall out?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. McLaughlin.
Let me see if it's not there. Yes, Mr. Chairman and Senator Lilly. In longer presentations that I've made on this topic, I have included a pie chart that shows the distribution of population of the 13 American colonies in 1780. And there are these giant colonies, and then there are some very little tiny ones like Delaware and Georgia. And essentially the Constitutional Convention was designed to figure out how to deal with the big and the small. We essentially had the same problem, and we decided we couldn't have a bicameral legislature. That would be a bad idea, a little too complicated. But we did try to work it out, and what we did was we said that there would be 100 votes in all on the CTIB board. We gave 5 to the Metropolitan Council because of its role in regional transportation investment, and then the 95 votes were distributed half based on population and half based on sales tax revenues generated. If you look at sales tax distribution, it goes from Washington County, your county, Senator Lilly, at about 5.5%, and Hennepin County generates 55% of the sales tax. So that's the big and the little, and there were other counties in between. And so we did a balance of revenues and population, 50% each. And then what we said was you had to have, so that's how many votes everybody got. Then we said you have to have 63 votes to pass anything, because Hennepin County ended up with 47 votes. If it were just a majority vote, the Hennepin County and Met Council could have controlled this. That wasn't fair. We understood that. And so we said you had to have 63 votes, and that was a closely watched number, I think it's fair to say. And you had to have the votes of three of the five counties. So you have a guarantee not only that you have to get a super majority, 63 votes out of 100, but you also have to have the votes of three full counties to go forward. If there were a vote to commit money to bonding, for example, a long-term financial commitment, a commitment in excess of 5 years or longer and in excess of 1 year's worth of revenue, you had to have 75 votes. Again, to protect the interests of all the parties. It's been, a very resilient formula, actually. And we have, frankly, have had unanimous votes on all of the grants that we have provided in our first 3 years, and we had a unanimous vote in favor of the issuance of the bonds. So I think people feel it's fair, and we've tried in the distribution to make sure that the aspirations of all the counties are reflected and also that we're consistent with the Met Council's vision.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Senator Lilly.
The second part of the question related to the revenues and expenditures of the CTIP.
The expenditures, I'm going to go back to the – here's the distribution of the expenditures. You can see that the bulk of the $317 million has been invested in capital. And the biggest chunks of that I'll give you the rough number is what, about $180 million to Central Corridor? Is that about right? That's the order of magnitude. 180 of that 247 went to Central Corridor, and the others went to other capital projects. The operating money, as I indicated, goes to North Star, Hiawatha, 35W BRT, and Cedar Avenue BRT, with the one anomaly being the 2008 grant that was the one-time grant to the Metropolitan Council for operations out of the chute because we weren't going to be able to start up as fast, and they had some financial problems. The revenue is coming in at approximately, we've ranged between 86 and $91 million a year. And those revenues, the distribution of those revenues, as I said, Washington County is on the lower end of that, and Hennepin is at the higher end. But the revenues have been coming in, and we've been pretty conservative. We wanted to make – I told our staff and our financial advisor, the last letter I want to write is, you know, dear county commissioner, we promised you X and we're going to give you a 0.9X. That's a letter I don't want to sign, and we've been very careful about that in terms of meeting the expectations and keeping the promises that we made.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chair McLaughlin, I'm looking at this almost $1 billion here in federal funds, and it says through 2010. What time period were those funds collected in?
Mr. McLaughlin.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cruz, they go back to Hiawatha grants, the first of which were probably in about 1996, I think.
96, okay.
Looks like you answered all of the questions for today anyhow. I know you'll be back and when we get into the bigger budget discussion or a representative will be. And appreciate you coming today and talking about CTIP.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be delighted to come back at any time and provide you with additional information on the investments that are being made and the really stellar performance of Hiawatha, which really was it really changed the debate. And we are still operating. We have the ridership now that's, and you'll hear from the Met Council, where it's exceeding estimates that were made for ridership in the year 2020. We're beyond those numbers. It's providing a great service, and we're continuing to grow. It grew 6% last year. So we think that this is contributing to the overall transportation needs of this region. We don't think transit does it all, but we do think there needs to be an investment in transit to complement the investment in roads and keep this economy strong, because we've got to have a strong infrastructure to have a strong economy.
Exactly.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next up is the Metropolitan Council. If you're ready to go, Mr. Shetnan, you can start your presentation. Thank you for joining us, and if you state your name for the record as we begin.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Judd Shetnan. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council. Appreciate the opportunity to be here today. Chair Haig could not join us today. However, she sends her regards, and she certainly enjoyed the opportunity to meet with you yesterday, Mr. Chair. And with that, I will move into our presentation. We were asked to present an overview to the committee about the Metropolitan Council's role in transportation and transit here at, to the Senate today. And there are a couple things that I'd like to discuss. The first is for some of the new members, I'd like to point out that the council has a variety of functions other than just transportation and transit. The council has about 3,700 employees. We run the state's largest wastewater treatment system. We have over $3 billion of infrastructure throughout the metro area. We have the ability to clean enough wastewater to fill the Metrodome 1.5 times per day through our wastewater treatment system. We also have our community development division, which administers the Livable Communities Grants. We have the state's largest HRA authority. We administer the Land Planning Act, the Municipal Land Planning Act, and we also oversee the regional park system. But today we're here to talk about transportation, and there's two areas that the council really focuses on, the first being Metropolitan Transportation Services, and the second being Metro Transit. So I've got Arlene McCarthy and Brian Lamb. Arlene is our director for Metropolitan Transportation Services. She'll be participating, and Brian is the general manager for Metro Transit, and he will be participating in our presentation as well. So I think we'll just get started.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. McCarthy.
Again, I'm director of Metropolitan Transportation Services. I will first go over some of the planning functions that we do at the council. You might be familiar with the acronym, and I will also point out, take a moment to say, we use a lot of acronyms in this presentation. We think we have spelled them out at least in one location, but please ask if we use something you don't understand. The council is what's known as the federally designated MPO, or Metropolitan Planning Organization. We must have an MPO in order to receive the significant amount of federal funds that we do here in the region. And we also then are responsible for the long-range plan, known as the Transportation Policy Plan, and a shorter-term federal programming. And then, as Judd said, we also have some transit functions. So focusing on transportation planning first, as I mentioned, we have our TPP. That must be a minimum 20-year outlook. And then we have the short-term TIP, which is a 4-year outlook. Of course, you can understand those are projects that we know we're going to be implementing, whereas the first is more of a plan. The feds require us to have what's called a UPWP. We work with MnDOT annually on that every year. And then the council participates in many transportation studies, primarily highways and transit. We're not necessarily the lead on those, but we work with other stakeholders such as counties, MnDOT, others who might be the lead. Through the TAB, we allocate regional federal funds, and there's a competitive process that the TAB leads on that. We also coordinate planning activities with many other stakeholders here in the region. We work particularly closely with MnDOT so that our plans are in sync. And then we have quite a public process that we utilize for all of these planning efforts. Just want you to know that our planning is what we call multimodal, and we've listed here the various modes that we include in our transportation policy plan. The council is also responsible for the regional travel forecast. So when you hear of a ridership forecast for a future transitway, that is generated by the council's regional forecasting model. And then, as I mentioned, we participate in quite a few corridor planning studies. I just wanted to let you know about the TAB, or Transportation Advisory Board. There is a federal requirement that local elected officials be involved in the distribution of those regional federal funds. And so the TAB allows the council as the MPO to meet that federal requirement. TAB is made up of 33 officials laid out in state statute, and by one, with a majority of 17, it is locally elected officials. Other staff are from state agencies such as MnDOT, MAC, the MPCA, and then some citizen appointments by various entities. TAB does go through the process of allocating the regional federal funds, and then the council either accepts that or denies. And I'm not aware of any time that we have denied TAB's action. And then TAB does have quite a process itself of technical staff made up of local, mostly counties and cities. And then they have some policy, some other subcommittees such as a policy and funding and programming group. The transit system will shift gears now from planning to actually transit operations. Just to, this slide summarizes all the different types of transit, and we'll go over each of these in detail. First will be Metro Transit, and as you can see, they have bus and rail ops. And then I'll come back and talk to you a little bit more about the MTS operations.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. For the record, my name is Brian Lamb. I'm General Manager for Metro Transit. It's my pleasure to be here today, and first I want to start off with that 2010 was a good year for Metro Transit. We carried 78 million rides this last year, which was only the fourth time in 30 years that we carried that many rides at Metro Transit, and it's up about 2.3% from 2009. Transit ridership is largely reflective of the economy as a whole, in that in 2009, our ridership actually dipped as the economy dipped regionally. But as the economy started to recover in 2010, so did our ridership. We are slowly improving our ridership, but we are actually increasing our ridership at a faster rate than our peers throughout the country. And in fact, in the last few years, we've grown from a ridership base from about the 15th largest transit system in the country to now we represent the 12th largest transit system in America. So who are our customers? Well, 78% of Metro Transit customers, we know from our surveys, take Metro Transit either to go to work, to and from work, or to go to and from school. We have several large markets, but none larger than the downtown Minneapolis market. In fact, several surveys have indicated that 40% of the people who work downtown actually get there by transit. Nearly 80% of the LRT riders and 56% of the bus riders actually have cars but choose transit. So one of the things that we are absolutely committed towards is making sure that we provide both the social need transportation network for those who either cannot drive, cannot afford to drive, or those kinds of things, but also provide a quality alternative for those who can. And that really is a kind of a key component of our growth strategy. In fact, 54% of the LRT riders based on our surveys have household incomes that are greater than $50,000. We, as I mentioned, do survey our customers on a regular basis. And on a regular basis, fully 90% are either fully satisfied or extremely satisfied with Metro Transit service. So it has provided a needed option for many people. How do we get there? Well, one of the things that we've done over the last several years is we've really rolled out a series of programs, none larger than the MetroPass program, which is our business relationship with metro area businesses, and where 244 companies are part of the MetroPass program. Just as recently as 2004, we had less than 100, so it's really been a growth portion of it. We have over 31,000 employees who are currently holding a MetroPass card in their hand. And it last year generated about 7.8 million rides, MetroPass holders did, which is about 10% of our overall ridership. In addition to that, we have programs that are geared towards primarily smaller employers as well. We have TransitWorks, which those employees are employers we sell passes to at about a 10% discount, and then they then sell them indirectly to the employees as well. We have several school pass programs. The oldest and the most successful by numbers is the U of M U Pass program, which last year we had 4 million U-Pass rides on our system. But in the last couple of years, we've expanded that concept to 48 other colleges in the metro area, and that's been really a growing area of ridership for us. Last year, we had 1.5 million rides from College Pass, and that might be the McAllisters, the Hamlins, the variety of colleges throughout the metropolitan area. This last year, we've actually expanded on a pilot program basis, a program with the Minneapolis Public School System. As you know, all public schools are facing budgetary challenges, and in Minneapolis, that's exacerbated a little bit because they still have several hundreds of students who are living one part of the Minneapolis city and actually go to school in another part, and the transportation costs are really get to be quite a burden on their overall budget. What we've done is, in a partnership with that school district, is to provide an alternative to the Yellow Bus School program by allowing high school students in those specific cases to use the regular route transit system to get to and from school. In addition, we have had a long-standing and great partnership for special programs such as the State Fair, where on an annual basis, and hopefully some of you over the course of the last several years have had an opportunity to take Metro Transit to and from the fair, and people from throughout the state have found that to be a very stress-free way to get to and from the fair. Metro Transit has really been focused on making enhancements throughout our system. We're going to talk on a variety of modes, but perhaps one most noticeable in the last year and a half has been the total reconstruction of 2nd and Marquette Avenues in downtown Minneapolis from Washington Avenue up to 12. And that was made possible by an urban partnership agreement grant that we received, one of five metro areas in the country that actually received this. And what that did was allowed us to reconstruct the street in a way that allowed double-width bus lanes. And rather than just doubling the transit capacity along those streets, by creating these double-width bus lanes, we actually tripled the capacity. So what the idea is, the city of Minneapolis, looking at their future growth and employment as one of their targets and realizing access to downtown is really going to be a key component to that growth, is trying to figure out how they can improve access to people, not just vehicles. And that's where one of their key priorities is to improve the transit accessibility through downtown. But it goes beyond that. We have extended, as part of a partnership of that urban partnership agreement, the MinPass lanes on South 35W that now extend essentially from Lakeville to almost downtown Minneapolis, and have moved the buses off of the shoulders and onto this higher average speed lane, and off to a very successful start. For those who have traveled in South Minneapolis in the metro area may have noticed that we have a new transit facility right in the middle of the freeway on 46th Street. That is the first of what we are planning to be have many online stations throughout the metropolitan area, allowing kind of the hub and spoke of local operations. Right now, local service will come up on the bridge level on 46th Street. People will be able to either walk down or take the elevator down to the freeway level in a climate-controlled environment and catch an express bus that will be traveling all day long from downtown Minneapolis to southern areas. And then on a time transfer basis, eliminate all the inconveniences that have been associated with trying to get to one part of the metro to in the past to another. As you know, and we'll talk a little bit more about this in a minute, last year we also opened up North Star Commuter Rail, and from an operation standpoint, we couldn't be more pleased. And customer satisfaction level, we couldn't be more pleased as well. Well, as I said, talk about a little bit more about that in a minute. But one of the key, metro area success stories in this last year was with the opening of the new Twins ballpark, how transit provided such an integral part of that success. And Minneapolis or Minnesota Twins will be the first one to acknowledge that. Fully 17 to 20% of all people going to Twins games are getting there by transit, but they're getting there in all modes. They're getting there with the extension of the Hiawatha line, an extra couple of blocks right to the Twins ballpark. They're getting there by North Star, and in fact, North Star has been averaging between 1,700 and 2,000 people per game for each one of those Twins games, and they're getting there by bus. We have, for instance, a special park and ride that operations that we set up on County Road 73 and 394, where over 250 to 500 people per game are hopping on that express bus and leaving the stress of trying to navigate downtown Minneapolis traffic behind. My fingers aren't as dexterous as Jed, so apologize for that. One of the things that we know is a big hurdle for customers is really that hurdle of trying to figure out how do I take transit. I know how to turn the key on my car, and I know how to get from point A to B by driving. But so one of the things we've concentrated over the last few years is trying to eliminate those kinds of questions. And one big thing is providing easier access to information. How do I get transit? Where does it come? How much does it cost? I don't want to look foolish. So our website enhancements have been a cornerstone of our success the last couple of years. To that end, we have expanded, for instance, our next trip operations. You can plug in your starting and ending address, and in the same way that you can do with Google Transit or whatever it is, they'll put together a bus itinerary or a transit itinerary for you with all sorts of different options so that you can choose what suits you best. It also has the opportunity, as we move more and more to real-time information, all of our buses are outfitted, for instance, with global positioning system technology. So instead of just telling the customer what time the bus is scheduled to be there, we'll tell them what time it will actually be there, adding to that extra level of confidence that customers need or potential customers would like as far as the transit system. One of the things that we're very pleased with the last few years is we've gone to a smart card technology. More and more people are just tapping and going as they get on the bus. It really speeds the access onto the bus. It's a very convenient tool for our customers. And right now, 40% of Metro Transit customers who use this on a daily basis use it on a tap-and-go system. And in fact, closer to 80 to 85% of our express customers are using that go-to card technology. We are trying to reach out and use touch customers in ways that are more and more relevant. In fact, right now we have over 1,000 Twitter followers, imagine that, on a daily basis, and have reached out and we've partnered with a private sector business for a Rides to Rewards program that we introduced just 3 months ago, and already we have 8,000 subscribers on this Rides to Rewards programs that's set up a lot like other kinds of rewards programs. You earn points by every time you use transit or patronize a business that is part of our partnership, and then ultimately they can redeem those points for lots of good rewards. Metro Transit understands that our future success is really part tied to walking the talk. And one of the areas that we like to believe that we're walking the talk is our Go Greener initiative. Right now we have 10% of our overall fleet, our hybrid bus fleet, and our hybrid buses average about 25% better fuel efficiency than our standard diesel. And in fact, all of our buses, starting with 2010, have the highest emission standards of any fleet in the industry. And in fact, the emissions coming out of a tailpipe of a 2010 generation bus have cleaner emissions than the air that you will breathe when you're walking downtown Minneapolis. And I think that's kind of an amazing transference from the old mindset of the stinky old buses to say that we've made that kind of progress. But we're not only doing that with our fleet, we're also doing that with our facilities. And, in fact, going back to that 46th Street station I was talking about in 35W, you may not realize it, but that actually is using geothermal heating and cooling and motion-activated LED lighting to reduce our energy consumption. And, in fact, the modifications that we've made in this last 2 years have reduced our facility-related CO2 emissions by 1,300 tons between 2008 and 2009. Now, if you, Mr. Chair, if I might, I just want to just talk about a few of our modes and one of the Hiawatha, as Commissioner McLaughlin was referencing the earlier testimony, is that Hiawatha really has had a very successful six-year operations. It operates 12.4 miles, has 19 stations, essentially from Mall of America to downtown Minneapolis, and just last year was extended to Target Field. We have now extended the platform so that we can run three-car train consists as opposed to up to this point, or previous to this point, we've only been limited to two-car train operations, which really allows us extra flexibility in matching the supply with the demand at various times of the day, et cetera. We have 10 new cars on order that will help us meet that growing demand for Hiawatha. Last year, we had 10.4 million rides, and that is the highest ridership that we've ever had on Hiawatha. Northstar. Northstar is our commuter rail operation and actually started in November of 2009. As I mentioned before, we are very pleased with its overall operations. It has, of those customers who are taking Northstar, it has a 95.6% satisfaction rate, and that's ironically the same rate in terms of our on-time performance. So it's operating very reliably. Where Northstar hasn't hit the mark yet is in terms of our overall ridership. And we are, although we are very pleased with the special event ridership, as I mentioned before earlier, that we have between 1,700 and 2,000 people attending the Twins games on a daily game basis, we are only averaging about 2,200 rides per day on Northstar on a regular weekday operations. That's less than what we were hoping for. How are we going to plan to move forward in the future? Well, one of the things that we are convinced that we need to really focus on introducing more people to Northstar, and we're going to do that in a variety of ways. And the reason why we believe that's the key to success is, again, going back to the people who try Northstar love it and will come back. And our surveys tell us that, as well as our customers directly. But the way we, November, for example, we tried a two-day promotion for people to come out and try Northstar. What happened as a result of that November marketing effort is that Northstar daily ridership jumped 14% and continued on that 14% plane since that time. So we think that we need to continue to work on ways to bring the Northstar option to people who live in the North Metro, Northwest Metro area. Finally, Mr. Chair, I'd like to just talk a little bit about Central Corridor, again, a project that Commissioner McLaughlin referenced. We're hoping yet this week or early next week to hear some very positive news from the federal government that it is taking its journey to its final step, which is the congressional review, and out of the Office of the Secretary, which is it resides right now. In which case, then there's a 60-day mandatory review period before we would be then eligible to receive our full funding grant agreement from the federal government. That means that the federal government commits to 50% funding of the Central Corridor. Just to familiarize or maybe re-familiarize yourself with why this project and what its hopeful outcomes are, is that we are forecasting 41,000 daily rides on the Central Corridor, which is successful as Hiawatha is. Hiawatha is right now averaging about 31,000. So we believe that Central Corridor will be successful right out of its gate. It does have a $957 million project budget, and about $145 million has been spent to date. All of the major contracts have been awarded, however, and with that kind of uncertainty behind us, we have a very high level of confidence that we'll be able to once again deliver this project on time and under budget, as we have all of the other New Start projects. When we look at the job creation elements of it, there are 571 jobs created yet this year as construction begins in earnest, and 800 jobs expected over the course of the next few years. And with that, Mr. Chair, unless there's any questions directed to me specifically, I'll turn it back to Ms. McCarthy.
Mr. Lamb, I have one quick question, and just out of curiosity, say I was to go out here and get on the new Central Corridor light rail and go to the to Target Field. How long will that take me?
Mr. Chair, the approximate travel time is about 44 minutes, I believe. And there's no parking, so there's advantages there.
Thank you. Any other? Senator DeCreef.
Thank you, Chairman. I have a question about your receipts that are received from the two rail lines, the Hiawatha and the North Star, compared to your earlier projections of what they would be at this time. Are you on target? Are you ahead of target? Or where are you at on those?
Mr. Chair, Senator, for Hiawatha, our receipts in terms of our overall percentage of our budget have and continue to exceed our budget projections. Right now, when we look at fare recovery is kind of the way we is kind of our standard, in that the fare recovery for Hiawatha varies between 38% of the total expense and 40% of the total expense. And what we were projecting coming into Hiawatha is that we would be between 30 and 35%. So we're exceeding that. In addition, Hiawatha each and every year has been under budget in terms of our overall operation. North Star, first year of operations, we're just closing the books right now. It's the receipts that we received through the fare box from the passenger have not lived up to our expectations, reflecting the ridership that has not lived up to our expectations, but we're only missing that by about 1 to 2%. We have offset that by having our expenditures down about 10% from our budget. So North Star actually finished favorable to our budget projections, even though our ridership was not as strong as we were projecting. And you can say, well, how can your ridership be off 21%, but your revenue is associated with that is only off a couple percent? Well, the reason is we are getting very strong ridership from the outlying stations that actually have a higher fare than the stations that are closer in that have a lower fare. And so the balance of that kind of addresses the discrepancy.
Okay. Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want a dissertation, but can you give me the executive summary on how you do your ridership calculations? You know, I'm particularly curious as you look at the Central Corridor and project an initial ridership that exceeds what you've seen on Hiawatha. I think that's great, but I want to make sure we're not being Pollyannish or optimistic, but that as a teacher, I want to know the science behind that.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I wish I could give you the specifics and I can follow up with the specifics, but there is a standard ridership modeling techniques that both the Metropolitan Council, but also with assistance from private sector modelers that we have refined over the years. Obviously, with Hiawatha, the actual experience exceeded those projections, so we use some of those kinds of modal preferences learning that we used and factored those into our new models that we have a high level of confidence for Central Corridor because now we are replicating a mode that we already know. Where North Star was a new mode and a new type of service. So every time you introduce a new mode, you have a higher than average number of variables that you end up having to kind of calibrate and then recalibrate once the actuals come in.
Thank you.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lamb, could you, in dollars and cents, help me out with this and tell me what the rider per rider subsidy is, first for the North Star and then for Hiawatha, and what the projected rider subsidy would be for the Central Corridor?
Mr. Lamb.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't have those numbers to their exact right in front of me, but let me give you an order of magnitude. Right now, when we're taking our lower than projected ridership actuals for North Star, this last year North Star's subsidy per passenger averaged about $18 subsidy per passenger. Our projections for the first year of operations was closer to like 13 to 14. With our growth, you know, it takes a few years for any service to kind of reach its maturation level. With North Star being the in the neighborhood of about a $10 subsidy per passenger over its long-term projections. By contrast, Hiawatha is running about $1.40 subsidy per passenger. And again, I will get these exact numbers. I'm giving this for order of magnitude, if you will. The bus service is running about $2 subsidy per passenger. Thank goodness I have Judd here reminding me that the question was a little bit more detailed. Our projections for Central Corridor is more in line with where our subsidy per passenger is running in actual for Hiawatha. So it's in that $1.30 to $1.50 range. And again, Senator, I can provide those updated numbers.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
You bet, Senator Perry, but I think everybody on the committee would like to see those numbers also, as you know, there's a lot of speculation out there as far as what those subsidy numbers are, and I think certainly as committee members, we want to know what you have. So thank you very much. Appreciate you getting that to us. Senator Perry?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lamb, how long will you expect the citizens to subsidize this? Is there a projected payback? Will there ever be a day where any of these will be able to survive on its own?
Mr. Lamb.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the long-range forecasts in terms of financial forecasts envision the continuation of subsidization of these services. So farebox revenue will take a portion, but make up a portion of the expense, but not all of the expense.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just, you know, I'm sure we're going to have this discussion about subsidy and, you know, public policy with respect to subsidy when it comes to transportation. You know, I don't think it's been the policy of any government, you know, since we've been doing transportation, to expect transportation of any form to, quote, pay for itself. You know, we do transportation in order for a lot of other benefits to occur to our larger economy and our larger community. So roads don't pay for themselves. They're subsidized. Likewise, you know, sidewalks and bikeways and public transportation is subsidized in some form or fashion. So, you know, I don't expect that we'll ever see transit pay for itself. It's not a private for-profit undertaking, and it wouldn't be. I mean, if the market wanted to move into that arena, they would. They would have by now.
Mr. Chair?
I'd just like to make a quick comment, and you can respond. Well, I guess that whole discussion gets back to what is a user fee and what is actually a subsidy. Roads and bridges are virtually all, if not all, paid for by user fees such as gas tax and license tab fees and things like that. But the user fees actually fall short is what I think where the discussion is really leading and what we're talking about in the actual costs of the ride. So that is one thing that has been discussed quite often in the discussions about this. Chair. I'm going to allow Mr. Lamb to respond.
Well, let me just respond to your comment. I think that is actually a deeply flawed analysis of how we pay for roads. And, in fact, they're not fully supported by gas tax, sales tax, and motor vehicle sales tax, but there's a lot more general fund sorts and property tax sources, as well as a lot of external costs get picked up from to pay for our road system. And you know, we can have this discussion, and we can provide the analyses and the evidence that roads are subsidized by some arguments to a greater degree than transit is, particularly when you count external costs and costs that are wasted out external to users into the larger societal costs that just need to be borne.
And certainly that might be the case, but it is also the case of the property taxes and external costs, as you prefer to call them, when it comes to transit also. So at that portion of it, I think we could probably argue back and forth whether
those costs and subsidies, if you will. The other part of the argument is how you get more transportation and more efficiency of dollar and more transportation for each dollar that you do spend, and transit wins that argument hands down.
Okay. Mr. Lamb?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to mention another piece of information I'd be happy to provide the committee is how Metro Transit's fare box revenue and percentage of recovery of its total cost compares to its peers throughout the country. And I think at least in that comparative sense, everyone will realize that it is a hard-working fare box.
Good. We'd appreciate that also.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say that in my mind it still boils down to one thing. The citizens will decide the subsidy that they're willing to expend on this. And I think we have to keep that in mind, because we are here because we were elected by the citizens. And I'm sure as they understand the types of subsidies in any part of government, they will let us know where they're at and what their feelings are. And I think we need to keep that in mind as we continually build things in this state. I still have issues with our state constitution in whether it dictates us to provide ridership opportunities to the citizens, or if it's telling us to build the roads and the bridges so that they themselves can move from point A to point B in their own means of travel. So I think we have to be cognizant that the citizens are going to be talking as they learn of the types of subsidies for these programs.
Thank you, Senator Perry. Senator Howe.
Chairman Gimsey, Mr. Lamb, also with those numbers, could you provide what the number one driver is for ridership? Is it convenience, or is it economics? I know we've seen a tick up with the economy of more people taking mass transit, but I think that would also be helpful.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I can do that.
Very good. Thank you. Any other questions? I think we'll move on, and don't want to cut Greater Minnesota short by too much here, so we'll just proceed with your presentation.
Fantastic. Mr. Chair, we will try to move through this relatively quickly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, again, Arlene McCarthy. I previously spoke about the planning responsibilities of Metropolitan Transportation Services, and now I just wanted to highlight the contracted operations. And that includes contracted regular route, very similar to the service that Metro Transit provides, and then Dial-A-Ride and the ADA services in the region. And also, you should know that the council passes through funds to the suburban transit providers. And collectively, those services require just under 800 buses, so it's a pretty large operation. On the contracted regular routes, just about 3.5%, so a pretty small share of the services are delivered by private contractors. We use a competitive bid process. We have about a half dozen contracts right now around the region, and they typically have about a five-year term before we rebid them. The service varies from local or suburban circulators, such as in Roseville, to express service. The Dial-A-Ride was significantly restructured last year. We completed that. We eliminated dial-a-ride where it duplicated with regular route service, and that allowed us to reallocate our funds to provide dial-a-ride service throughout the seven-county metro where there is not a regular route option. So in other words, everybody has a choice or an option of dial-a-ride or regular route, but not both. We worked with the counties on how to deliver that service with a variety of options. This graphic shows the five different contractual relationships the council has. Carver and Scott County collectively actually provide the service with their own providers. We have a sole source agreement with them. But otherwise, the contracts have been competitively procured and awarded in the other four areas. We also have Metro Mobility, or the Americans with Disability Act service. This is federally required. Metro Mobility is provided in the same areas where there is regular route service. In other words, if you could catch a public transit bus on a regular schedule that offers all-day service, then you must have Metro Mobility or ADA service available to you. We do not provide this out in the areas where dial-a-ride is provided. State statute requires that this is what's called door-through-door service. In other words, we escort our customers from their door when we pick them up and through their the door of their destination. And this is an area it's important for you to know that there are federal requirements that we must provide. In other words, we cannot deny rides in a large part of the service area. The federal law is three-quarter mile either side of regular route transit. So that's a very cognizant budget item for the Met Council to be federally compliant there. And we do get looked at quite closely in our reviews by the feds on that. Then also we pass through funds to the suburban transit providers. 12 communities back in the 80s elected to what we call opt out of the regular route system. Four cities provide the service. Those four cities are Maple Grove, Plymouth, Shakopee, and Prior Lake. And then there are two joint powers boards. One of them is called Southwest Transit, and they represent the cities of Eden Prairie, Chanhassen, and Chaska. And then the second joint powers is Minnesota Valley Transit Authority, and that represents the cities of Apple Valley, Rosemount, Eagan, Burnsville, and Savage. So they're responsible for their own services, but we provide the buses for them, and we pass through their motor vehicle sales tax.
And Mr. Chair and members, I'm going to briefly talk about sure. The transit funding for both our operating and for our transit capital. And I know that we will get into this much further once the governor puts out his budget recommendations. But I thought just for the committee that it would be good just to go over the different funding sources. The first is the motor vehicle sales tax. The council will receive 36% of the statewide MVEST in this fiscal year. We receive a state general fund appropriation. We also receive federal funds, and we can use those federal funds for preventative maintenance in our operating budget. As we mentioned, we use fares, and then there's also local and other funds that we use, them being the CTIB funds, the county's sales tax, the quarter cent sales tax, and then some of the advertising revenue. This pie chart will show you that our calendar year 2011 operating budget is $405 million. And as you can see, the motor vehicle sales tax, the passenger fares, the state general fund, and federal funds make up the vast majority of our revenues. And then in our expenses between Metro Transit bus and North Star, we've got Metro Transit making up over about 71% of the overall budget. I'd like to move on to the transit capital funding sources.
Senator Hall?
Mr. Chair, Ms. McCarthy, when you said that you passed through the 36%, or you passed through the motor vehicle sales tax, mm-hmm. is it the whole 36% those counties? It can't possibly be all of the motor vehicle sales tax, can it?
Ms. McCarthy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator. No, there is a share, 36% of the 40% motor vehicle sales tax that is for transit. 36% comes to the metro area, and 4% to Greater Minnesota, which MnDOT will speak to. Of the 36%, by previous law, a share goes to the suburban providers, and that is what we pass through to them. They're a statutory share of the motor vehicle sales tax. And then the council uses the rest here, as Judd was just showing, in our budget for our operations.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair, could you share with that number with me, what that statutory number is?
Of the MS?
Oh,
Mr. Chair and Senator, the council share of MVEST, you know what we will do? We will follow up with you after this meeting to make sure that we are on the right page, on the same page, and we'll send a response to everybody, because I'm a little tripped up at what you're asking for here. Is it okay if we move on?
It is.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members, the transit capital funding sources for the regional transit system is made up of a variety of ways as well. The first being state bonds. Those are state general obligation bonds. We've used those for many of our large transit and transitway projects, in particular, most recently the Central Corridor line has received over $90 million worth of state general obligation bonds. We also have regional transit capital. Those are also known as RTC bonds. We generally ask for those every year, just for small capital purposes. We generally we issue those and pay for the debt service for those bonds through a property tax levy that the council imposes. We also receive federal funds. We use the CTIB sales tax for capital use, and then also money from the regional rail authorities and some local entities as well when we are funding our transit capital program. Just a little bit more discussion on our regional transit capital. These are funds that, again, I mentioned we use through a property tax levy within the transit capital levy communities. It's also known as the transit taxing district. You can see those cities are outlined within the green subset or inset of the larger map there. The legislature gives us the authority to levy for that, and again, that is used for bus replacement, bus shelters, park and ride lots, some maintenance, and again, those cities that are within the green pay for that. However, as Arlene mentioned earlier, we do have service called the Dial-A-Ride service that extends beyond that subset, and those services are supported by the capital, at least the buses and the maintenance for those. Those services are supported by the capital paid by those folks who live within the green inset of the taxing district. The legislative auditor speaks to this in their request, and I'm sure that when the committee hears from them early next month that this will be a interesting discussion area.
Yes, Senator Seaman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Shenton, I am still curious. I know we've seen it in the past, the map that shows the metropolitan area and the regular route service that goes to different areas. And we've had this discussion before about how there's a disparity between the regular route service on the West Metro versus the East Metro. So I'm wondering if you can give any more information on that or what the council's doing to address that, or if you have ridership rates per capita by county.
So
that shows, perhaps that addresses whether this is a legitimate concern I have.
Mr. Chair and Senator Seaman, we do not have that updated information. We can certainly provide that. What we do have, and one of the things that we did when we restructured our Dial-A-Ride system was to make sure that everybody in all seven counties had access to transit. That was one of the main points of that, is that we, once upon a time, there wasn't transit available for everyone within the seven county metro area. But Senator Seaman, I know that what you're asking for is a different set of information, and we will provide that. It is what we do have in our presentation is an explanation to show who uses the transit system from on our park and rides, who are coming from outside of the taxing district, and then also who uses it from beyond the seven county metro area, so we can really show that our transit system isn't just used by those folks who live and reside within the current taxing district.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Stephen.
Just to follow up on that point, I understand that, and that chart is in the packet about the people that use it outside of the transit taxing district. but I still think that those rates would be helpful, because if you don't have regular route service, you're not going to get the same ridership as if you have dial-a-ride. I mean, there aren't people who commute into the Twin Cities aren't going to use dial-a-ride every day, and so we really need, I think, to look into those numbers, to look for equity between different regions of the metropolitan area. And I understand that there are more parking rides in the West Metro, but I also think it's a question of the chicken and the egg, and if you build them, people will ride it, and if you don't have it in certain sections of the Metro, then there is an opportunity, or there's limited opportunities for regular route service.
Mr. Shetland.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Sieben, I understand completely, and we will get that information together for you, so thank you.
Senator Dibble?
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and I think the issues that Senator Lilly raised earlier and Senator Sieben is raising now about regional equity and delivery of service is a good one, and I hope we can spend some time on that. And also, I think I heard that the legislative auditor's report is going to be presented here next month. Did Mr. Shetland just say that?
That's the 11th.
Okay, great. Because that, I look forward to the conversation in the committee about this very issue that Mr. Shetland is talking about, and that's you know, folks in the green part of this map that are being taxed for capital effort of Metro Transit, and folks in the white area and beyond are using a lot of those capital assets in our. I don't actually mind. I mean, sometimes I mind depending on the proportion. I don't mind. You know, for example, with the county state aid formula. Most of those revenues are generated in the metro area. A lot of them get used in other parts of the state, but everyone's participating in that effort, you know, through the gas tax and all the other sources for the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. It's a different matter altogether when only one area is actually going to the effort, and there's not even any participation in another part, geographic part, yet those assets are being used. So it's an important issue for us to grapple with.
Sure, yes. We'll have another opportunity to discuss that with the report, but thank you, Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rastel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm pleased that, I'm just going to echo Senator Dibble's comments. I'm pleased that that you were at the Legislative Audit Commission meeting, and you certainly have been a member of that group as well, and that you are planning to have a hearing on that report here. Mr. Shetland and I would very much like to request that Chair Haig make herself available in addition to whoever else she wants to have present here, but I would like for her to be here to respond to it.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, we did speak with Senator Gimsey about that yesterday, and we and Chair Haig intends to be there, so we will make sure that happens.
Thank you. Yeah, I believe that would also be very important for her to be able to engage us on those subjects. So thank you, Senator Rest.
Okay. Mr. Chair, we will zip through the last couple slides here.
Very good. We'll go until 2:30. We've moved the Greater Minnesota Transit portion to another hearing date. We don't want to cut them short and leave them less opportunity to talk about Greater Minnesota. So we'll make plenty of time for them another time. Thank you for agreeing to that. Mr. Shetland.
Great. Mr. Chair, members, now we'd like to give you a brief overview of the regional transit usage. And Ms. McCarthy will handle that for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This chart shows you our ridership. As Brian Lamb mentioned, we're rebounding a little bit here in 2010, which is good news with the economy. You can see that the yellow is rail, and, of course, Hiawatha opened in 2004 partially in mid-year. The 2005 was the first full year of rail operations, so that's a relatively new portion of our ridership. 2008, you'll recall, is when gas prices were at their highest, and that was reflected in our ridership, and gas prices are one of the in addition to the economy and employment, a big factor in our ridership. But you can see the general trending there. Then we'll move on to some park and rides, which I think speaks to some of the more recent questions, or at least partially. As you can see here, we showed what we call our major park and rides. These are all at least 100 spaces, but quite frankly, many of them are much larger than that. And we collectively have about 29,000 spaces now here in our region. And that's about double what it was, slightly more than double what it was about a decade. So we really have been constructing and providing service to a lot more facilities. And we have an emphasis on regional facilities here. What we have found over the last couple decades is that it's much better to have larger park rides that serve multiple cities that have high frequency of service. People really like it if they don't if they know a bus comes during the peak commuter hours much more frequently. That's much more attractive than, say, having one bus every half hour for a total of three trips. So that's really been our emphasis in our growth over the last few years with express service. Many of our largest facilities are full. And we've listed some of them there. And these facilities, several of them are in the 800 space size range. So these are pretty good size facilities that we have here.
Senator Sengel.
Chairman, may I just interrupt to ask, and I'm going back to the last slide.
Mm-hmm.
It's just kind of curious, at least to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I can identify which one is Highway 52 coming up from Rochester, but is the fact that there's not a park and ride there just a function of it's not there, that's never been looked at, or it's not deemed to be important? Or
Mr. Chair, our park and rides are built based on anticipated demand. And we have quite a good model that we use in the region. We developed it back in the early 2000s to help us understand where we should spend our limited resources, both capital and operating dollars. So we have put together a model. It looks at employment rates, a number of people from what we call the service area of a proposed park and ride, and their employment destinations, because that helps us understand. And we do have a long-range park and ride plan, and I can take a look to see what is forecasted. But that's part of what we'll be providing in response to Senator Sieben's question earlier, is we do work very hard on identifying where we should provide future park and ride capacity in the region.
Senator Hall has a question.
Chairman, Senator Sinjim, there is a park and ride at 52 in Hampton. There's just no bus service there. I mean, people park there and ride with somebody else. And that lot seems to be full.
Right,
yeah.
Sure.
Well, taxi
Oscars.
Thank you. Ms. McCarthy.
Just to highlight some of Judd's comments earlier about what we call the transit taxing district, what this slide shows is that within the seven-county metropolitan area, but outside of the area that is taxed, about 10% of our users at the park and rides are from that area. We do surveys every year. We do park and ride counts, and every other year we plot the license plates so we know where folks are coming. So about 10% in this area. And then the next slide shows how many are from beyond the seven-county metro area, and that's actually more at 15%. Some of this we would expect, particular up to the northwest with North Star Corridor. Brian mentioned earlier that fare revenue was higher in part because we were getting higher ridership from the further out park and rides on North Star, and I think that's reflected, as you'll see, that cluster of dots in the top left corner of this map is actually folks driving from St. Cloud, most likely down to the North Star park and rides. But you can see that there are quite a few folks outside of the Seven County Metro who are also using the facilities. And I think this emphasizes that we locate our park and rides along transportation corridors. That's what we're trying to capture, is people traveling down the highway and having convenient locations and service for them. And then, Mr. Chair, I'm going to just spend a couple moments on transitway development. I think that Commissioner McLaughlin spent quite a bit of time on some of this. But you should know that our transportation policy kind of lays the framework for potential future transit ways. Again, we look out at least 20 years, so right now we're looking out to 2030. We do modeling and capital and operating cost estimates at a pretty high level. I call it a screening to identify the corridors that we think we would want to pursue as transit ways. And I'll have Judd move to the next map while I kind of summarize the text on the previous slide. We have 7 red lines on this map, and those are corridors that are well on their way. They're either in operation or they're what we call the locally preferred alternative. That's a federal term, has been selected. In other words, Southwest is the most recent corridor to have its locally preferred alternative selected, and that was where the alignment and the mode of LRT was selected about mid-year in 2010. Then there are 8 corridors that are what we call candy stripe, red and white. The idea is they should someday turn to red when they're developed into a transit way. They are in various stages of determining what their solution will be. And we don't know what the alignment will be or what the mode will be, but we would anticipate a mixture of rail and various bus solutions. Then we have 9 corridors in blue, more in the urban core of the region. These are on streets, what we call arterial streets, typically county roads. And these are already today, for the most part, extraordinarily high-volume bus routes. They serve a lot of people today, and the idea here is to provide some improvement of service through what we call arterial BRT. There is not the width in these roads to provide dedicated right-of-way or right-of-way like a hot lane, so it's more shared space with auto traffic, but there are things we can do to speed that bus service up and provide better amenities to increase ridership on, again, these already very high-volume ridership routes. And then we also have in yellow here the express buses with transit advantages, and those transit advantages is most typically bus-only shoulders. We in this region, again, working extraordinarily closely with MnDOT, have over 300 miles of bus-only shoulders. We're way ahead of the game nationally in this, quite frankly. And that is a bus-only shoulder is good, but it's not quite as good as a dedicated lane or something like a hot lane. But we work hard to provide on-ramps and just very small incremental improvements that can improve this trip time. And I will say, Brian mentioned the Marquette and Second improvements in downtown Minneapolis. That's huge to our express riders also because, ironically, in some cases, a good portion of those express trips were previously spent going through downtown. So we look at the total trip and try to improve that. So this is our transitway vision. And just to let you know, these projects do take a long time. The first box here is what we do in our policy plan, where we do screening and identification. But then the next steps are more typical. There's variations to this, but we just wanted you to know that alternatives analysis typically takes about 2 years. Preliminary and engineering is another 2 years. Final design is typically a year, and construction can vary, but 3 to 4 years for a light rail project or commuter rail is typical. So you're looking at least 8 years for these projects once they've kind of been identified as even a potential corridor. So, Mr. Chair, we'll stand for additional questions. Thank you.
We have about a minute here. Very good bringing that right up to the end. We appreciate it very much. And Mr. Shetton, Ms. McCarthy, and Mr. Lamb, thank you very much for your presentation.
Great. Mr. Chair, I will follow up with the committee members with all the questions that were asked and provide a detailed written explanation. So we'll get that to the committee members here as soon as we can.
Being no other business, meeting is adjourned.